So it's fair to say humans would be pretty pathetic without all their tools.
No, absolutely.
I mean, this goes way
you
beyond...
like my Phillips screwdriver.
That and techie computers, car keys, wrenches, and brooms. But it goes way, way beyond that. The narrative of civilization is, in fact, the story of how human brains have taken objects from the environment and used them to enhance human abilities. From making us stronger with your screwdriver, your hammer, your pliers. Tools like language that allow us to communicate. Tools that enable us to make music. Musical instruments are tools. To giving us new body parts altogether.
Telepathic helmet is still pretty early in its development, so I think that's best regarded as a scenario rather than something that's actually going to be available in the near future.
Telepathic helmet? That's scientist Brad Allenby on our show last month talking about some wild ideas for new military devices that are just on the drawing board. But as this week, the World Science Festival opens here in New York City, among the most exciting frontiers of science right now are the emerging new collaborations between machines and brains, and they're very much real. Joining us now are Gary Small, author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. He's also one of the world's top innovators in science and technology that melds the mind and machines. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
Also, Rosalind Picard is here. Roz is known internationally for envisioning and conducting research in technologies that recognize human emotions. She's a principal investigator and a professor at the MIT Media Lab and author of Effective Computing. Roz, good morning.
Good morning, John and Celeste.
So let's start with you. Roz, how good are machines getting at recognizing human emotions and actually figuring out what's going on in our brains?
Well, the goal is to get machines to be as good at recognizing them as people are, but they do it differently. So they're actually better in some ways and they're much worse in some other ways.
And in terms of developing tools that actually help in practical applications, what are you working on right now or what do you see on the horizon?
We've got a lot of new things. In fact, I'm going to be trying to show some of them working live Friday night at the forum. We have technology that reads facial expressions that sees, for example, if you look interested or not interested, if you look pleased or displeased. And we have technology that also reads some of your physiological state, like if you're excited or calm. And we're debuting a brand new technology that can read your heart rate using just a camera.
Gary Small, the narrative of human beings collaborating with machines and that altering our sense of self is a very, very old and fascinating story. How far does it go back?
It goes back probably hundreds of thousands of years when our ancestors first developed a handheld tool. And what's remarkable is that was a milestone in brain evolution. It led to very rapid evolution of the frontal lobe, the thinking brain. So we became more social animals. We developed language skills just as a result of this simple handheld tool.
You know, but humans have a pretty troubled relationship with our tools. And on one sense, you know, we test animal intelligence based on whether they know how to use tools. We have things like the $6 million man where we glorify the melding of the man and the machine. But we have an equal number of very disturbing accounts, say Isaac Asimov and iRobot, where our machines dominate us and we lose control.
My grandmother told me TV would rot my brain. It didn't happen. It's good. It's
sure about
bad.
That, Gary?
Well, I would have been much better off perhaps today had I not watched so much television as a kid. However, the brain is complex and the technology is complex. So it's not all good. It's not all bad. It all depends on the context.
But as part of what you're saying, and I want to get Roz's reaction to this as well, that the brain is predisposed to being malleable based on our interaction with objects and computers and tools of all kinds, Gary Small?
Our brains change from moment to moment depending on what we're stimulating our brains with. Today, the average young person spends about 11 and a half hours a day with their technology. We know from our studies at UCLA that just searching online will relatively rapidly rewire the brain. So we have, yes, a possible threat, but a huge opportunity here.
So, Roz Picard, when technologies are developed that, you know, literally open the skull and try to create appliances that actually interact with neurons, in your experience, and I know this isn't necessarily your research, but in your experience, is the brain sort of open to this kind of malleability? Is the brain kind of welcome these sorts of collaborations?
Oh, golly, no. I think the surgeons, of course, know there's lots of physical rejection, and there's also social-emotional problems, too, right, with trying to adapt to something else that's a part of you. You know, we did some of the early cyborgian systems where our computers were wired into your hair, and we wore them around the clock. And maybe one individual started to accept it, but then, of course, they couldn't get through airport security, you know, without being majorly disassembled there, which was quite an ordeal in some cases.
The technologies that you're developing, where machines are recognizing human emotions and heart rates and things of that kind, how adaptive is the brain on the other side to treating essentially machines as almost living creatures, intelligences?
Well, it's definitely the case that people will interact socially with machines. You know, a lot of people have named their cars. They'll see a little wind-up robot wag its tail, and they'll say, oh, that's cute, and they'll give it a name, and look at it roll over, and oh, and it looks like it likes you, you know, that kind of attribution. So we interact quite naturally and socially with them and attribute them emotions. But we're taking that a step further, actually, and giving them mechanisms that really try to imitate the roles that emotions play in people, and that actually notches it up another level. They're not just appearing to be a certain way. They may actually have mechanisms that imitate some of our feelings.
And Gary Small, do you envision the time when there may be some sort of interface, some sort of actual feedback loop that's developed that will take information from the environment, interact with the brain, and then take brain impulses and push that information out to do something more than just move a hand or make a television turn on or off?
Well, there's already brain-computer interface technologies that allows people to control computers just through their mental thoughts. So in the future, we may not be wearing a Bluetooth earpiece, but a little sensor on our forehead. And if you want to meet your friend for coffee, you just have that thought. It'll be transmitted wirelessly, and you can sip and drink your cappuccino and just read each other's minds.
Roz, as scared as some of us are about all of these developments, do you think the digital revolution has really warmed people to the idea of wearing digital prostheses of one kind or another to interact with the environment?
I think if they look cool, yes, but we want to stay in control. We don't want our thoughts transmitted or our feelings transmitted without our control.
All right, Rosalind Picard from the MIT Media Lab, part of the World Science Festival here in New York, the author of Effective Computing, and Gary Small, the author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. He's also going to be at the World Science Festival here.
You know
in
who
New
else
York
is
going to
be at the World Science Festival?
Stephen Hawking was here last night.
Bill Gates, and we are going to be speaking with Bill Gates. He and his father join us tomorrow morning to talk about building a successful family and successful life. Be sure to join us for that. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.